So, last time we talked about doing page replacement. We had gone over before sort of the mechanics of page replacement. So we focused mostly on the decision of what page do we actually get rid of to put in new data. And we had different metrics we could use for that. And we focused mostly on optimizing the hit rate, even though we mentioned that wasn't really what we cared about. What we really cared probably about throughput, the amount of work we actually got done, like how much time we are wasting, like bringing out a page. But hit rate like approximates that because hit rate is just how often do we do replacements, and replacements are expensive, even if not all of them are as expensive as others. And we alluded to the fact that, well, maybe hit rate isn't the only thing we should be caring about. Like if we have multiple users, maybe we care about fairness, we might have these other metrics. But for now, and mostly in this class, we'll be ignoring those, even though they are important. And for optimizing hit rate, we had an ideal policy, which we called Blaney's Min. And it was relatively simple. We just replaced what will be accessed furthest in the future. Problem is, we can't implement it. We don't actually know everything the program's about to access. And if we did, well, maybe there's smarter things we could do. So we needed to guess what would be accessed furthest in the future to have sort of a possible policy. And the primary way we guessed was with this idea of a working set model that each program had a subset of its memory in use. If we wanted to measure what that subset is, we just see what is it using now. That's going to be what it's going to be using in the future. Similar idea to locality that you may have seen in some other courses. And based on this, we have this approximation of Blaney's Min, which was this LRU for least recently used policy. And this is a possible approximation of Blaney's Min, assuming the program is under this working set model, or we have at least temporal locality, meaning things that are used now in the now or likely to be used again in the near future. And well, LRU, it was at least possible to implement, but we learned that it's not practical to implement because there's just too much work, maintaining this ordering on every access. And it turns out that we don't really care about precisely knowing what's least recently used. It's not the ideal anyways. The ideal is this thing where we predict the future and we're kind of guessing. So what we really care is that we just avoid evicting things that were used recently. And we had two approximations we talked about. We have this second chance approximation and this seek approximation with an active plus inactive list. And the key idea that was common among those is that we checked accesses in some time window. In the case of these policies, the time window was determined by how quickly we were going through the list of pages. And in the case of the seek policy, this number of pages we labeled as inactive, where inactive in the seek policy meant not that necessarily it wasn't in use, but that we made a guess that it wasn't in use that we were trying to confirm. So, this is sort of our overview of these LRU approximation policies. And working in this scenario where we really care about hit rate and we assume we only act when we see a page being accessed and we need to do something to make that work. We're going to talk today about cases where this working set model breaks down and where we're going to be a little more proactive. But before I move on, are there questions about things we covered last time? So let's talk about being proactive. So far, we're not doing anything until memory is full and we're out of space, you know, and out of space. And that's the only case where we evict pages or even write back pages, you know, that are modified. And this model, we could make an OS which works this way, but real OSs don't do this because there's more efficient things we can do. And we're going to talk about both of these issues, both writing back pages at some time, which is a little sooner, and evicting pages at some time, which is a little sooner. So writing back. So there's actually a reason we want to do this besides efficiency. So one reason we want to write back pages sooner is because we don't want to have to wait any longer than necessary when I need to bring in some new data to take out the old data. But there's actually a bigger reason why we really want to write back pages proactively. And this is about what happens when we, say, lose power. That if we only wrote back pages when we need to, well, let's say I'm editing like a Word document, that Word document that I'm actively editing, well, of course, it's going to be cached. And if we don't write it back, except if we need to, well, if I lose power, even though I saved my file, it didn't actually get saved to disk. And that would be really, really bad for most users. And we don't want to do that. So the solution that we're going to use for this is that we're going to be, you know, pretty active about actually sending back at least file data. That we're going to track those dirty bits. We're not just going to check, was this written to when we need to evict the page. We're going to check more often, and we're going to have some goal, which is typically based on, you know, making the answer to this question, how much data could I lose if I lose power or I have a crash? We're going to try to make the answer to that question have, you know, some bounds that, you know, aren't embarrassing. So example of one goal is you might say you should lose no more than 90 seconds, or if the application wrote and closed a file that basically right away it should be written back. So there's these various goals you can come up with, and OSs choose one of those, and these are all common ones, in order to limit the answer to that question. And this has an incidental effect that, well, now there's less work to do when we're evicting pages. If I want to stop caching that Word document now that I've not worked on it, I'm not going to have to wait to write it back because I will have done that proactively before I actually evict it from the cache. So that's about write back. And that was part of our page replacement cost. There's another part of our page replacement cost, which is just figuring out what pages to replace. If you remember with our second chance policy, we had these cases where we needed to go through the entire list of pages. And one thing we did to help with that is that's why we had these smaller inactive lists to make that less of a concern. But we still might have to scan through a whole lot of pages to figure out which is the candidate for the next replacement. And this is kind of disappointing if we think of like what a normal desktop looked like. That I'm using my desktop, I'm just, you know, using it casually, and I step away for a bit, and then I start an application, and there was this period where, you know, I wasn't doing much, where it sure would have been nice if I took advantage of that free time to figure out what page am I evicting next. And this is something real OSs do, that, you know, they will do something where they evict earlier in the background. And they don't necessarily need to evict a lot, they just are going to choose a bunch of pages to evict. And they can free up the page by removing it from, you know, evicting, you know, means that we're going to remove from page tables, etc., in advance. So we can even lower that cost more. And you might say, well, this means we're evicting more than we have to. So this is a trade-off. And something we can do to make that trade-off not so bad is, you know, maybe we have, you know, mechanism to unevict. To unevict if page is used before replacement. So what we might say is like, we'll remove it from the page tables, but you know, if we get a page fault trying to load that back in, we'll have something somewhere we remember that, oh, we pre-evicted this because we thought this was the next thing we were going to get rid of, but I guess that guess was wrong and we can save a little time. But hopefully that wouldn't actually make much of an impact because we should be making good choices about what pages to evict. You know, we should be choosing things that we likely aren't using anyways. But this idea of doing all that work we were doing on replacement in advance is another way we can speed up the replacement process. And this works well because we have idle time. That even though we're doing the same amount or maybe even more work in total, we're hopefully doing the work when I'm not trying to launch the program that needs the new memory, but earlier on when I don't care so much. So questions about our sort of proactive strategies for speeding up page replacement by doing the work earlier. Okay. So our proactive strategies were questioning this first part of our model for page replacement has been so far, which is that it's entirely based on when accesses happen. There's a second part we're going to want to question, which is going to be about this LRU assumption. So our assumption is choosing what pages we want to replace. You know, we just have to rely on the past history. And this actually doesn't always work well. So, you know, a question is like, when does it not work? And there are actually common patterns where it doesn't work. So I have an exercise for this, so a little poll. So here are a bunch of sort of types of memory, things we might keep cached in memory. You know, so we have the code for handling out disk space errors, global variables, the initial values that were loaded from a file, and so on. And my question here is, you know, LRU might be a poor choice for some of these. So which ones of these does LRU seem like a bad choice for? You know, which one of these is LRU going to give us, you know, not a great result? So I'll give you some time to think about this. And in some cases, maybe the answer, you know, isn't entirely clear-cut. And a subtlety here is we're asking not which ones of these are not going to be going to be cached by LRU, but which ones of these is LRU not going to make the right decision? Which is a, you know, that's a subtle distinction point. So, remember, we care about, you know, what decision is LRU going to make, and is that correct? I see we have absolutely no sort of consensus. Okay. So this is going to be a real discussion. Give people maybe another 30 seconds. Okay, so we have we have absolutely no consensus here, and I think there's some confusion here about about distinguishing between L or U not catching something, and not catching something being the wrong decision. So, for example, in the case of one. We shouldn't cache this. We probably shouldn't cache this. This. And L or U probably won't cache this much. Probably won't cache this. Won't cache this for long much. Cache this. Unless there are a lot of added disk space errors. So L or U is probably not going to get this. We're probably not going to cache this in the first place with our L or U policy. And if we do, if we cache it for more than a minimal amount of time, it's probably because there's out of disk space errors. And if that happened, if we get like one out of disk space error, probably we're going to get a bunch. If like something's wrong with our system. So L or U actually does okay for this. Like it mostly is not going to keep it cached because that if these errors aren't happening, and if they are, it is, and that's about what we want to do, I think. So I think this is a case where L or U performs well. Shouldn't have been selected. Then we have the initial value of the shell's global variables. So our question here is, will L or U perform poorly? Well, this stuff is going to be, if we don't change the values, the shell's going to use this a bunch and it's going to stay cached. If we keep starting shells, it's going to stay cached and we probably actually want it cached. Probably should cache. L or U will keep cached. If not changed. So I think L or U does okay on this, or if we keep starting shells. So like if we think of like, portal, like it's going to keep this stuff cached in portal because people are starting shells all the time. So then let's think about long movies that are too big to fit in memory and played from beginning to end. So in this case, L or U is going to cache the part of the movie we just read, and by the time we get to the end of the movie, we're not going to have the beginning of the movie cached again. So L or U is not going to help us here. So we probably shouldn't cache, first of all. Shouldn't cache. Because we can't keep the whole movie in memory anyways. There's no part of, and if we're going to cache something, we should like choose a part of it and keep that around for the next time we play the movie. But L or U will try to keep the last part in memory, but we don't care about that. but we no longer care about it. So what LRU is going to keep cached is the stuff we just watched that we're least likely to watch in the near future. So LRU does the precisely wrong thing here. You know. Which I thought you should have, you know. So will perform poorly. So will perform poorly. So this is, maybe I'll use a different color. The correct binding for that. So this is the answer I would have checked. And the same applies to these long movies. If we're going to cache part of the movie, we want to do that. So the question is, don't people rewind from beginning to end? This is why I said played from beginning to end. But yes, that is a concern. We want to cache a little bit of it. For the web server, if we're downloading it and people rewind, then they're going to probably not rewind by having their web browser request back in the movie. So the web server case is clearer as far as the question of what about people rewinding back a few seconds they're going to use their downloaded copy, presumably, because they're downloading the thing. Is our guess. So I would think that these are poor. So in the case of the web server, you know, once we download a whole movie, we're going to not cache the beginning anymore, and that's the next part we're going to get requested. Then we have this question of files that are parsed when loaded and overwritten when saved. So if they're parsed, you know, you know, presumably this means, you know, read once. I should go back to the original color. So presumably parsed means read once and used to make a data structure. Data structure, because if you think of like typical parsing, we're gonna make, like load a struct with the data. And overwritten with saved means not read again. So here, LRU does poorly because we read the data once, and LRU is going to keep it cached, even though after we've read it, we don't care anymore. Because, you know, we're going to overwrite it when we use it again, most likely. So assuming we usually save a new version, you know, if we save always. If we always save, then that, and here we'll have the caveat, if no rewind. You know, if no rewind. And then we have frequently requested HTML files. If an HTML file was popular, it's likely to have been requested recently, so LRU does pretty good on that. Even though it's not actually, you know, maybe not the optimal policy for that case. So questions on sort of why I'm arguing that three of these probably, it depends on the details, aren't a good fit for LRU. And this is cases so where we have, it's too big to fit in memory, and we're probably going beginning to end, so we're scanning over the data, and LRU is just going to cache stuff that we probably don't care about for too long, you know, rather than, you know, do something possibly useful of keeping either part of the file in memory or spending our precious memory on other things that are going on in the system. So question is, what's the argument for the second one? If we always save, then we aren't going to read the data we just parsed again, but LRU is going to keep it cached. Does that answer your question? Okay. So this is like two types of scenarios, and these are actually, so question is about the web server version. So in the case of these long movies, they're too big to fit in memory, and the client's going to probably request assuming the client requests the whole movie, then once we've sent it to one client, we're caching the end of the movie, and that's not the next thing we need. When we bring in the beginning of the movie, we're going to have to throw out the end of the movie, and you know, we're just not making efficient use of our memory. Okay. Other questions about these scenarios? Okay. So we have these two classes of patterns where L or U performs poorly. One is where we only read things once, like we load a file and going to save a new version anyways. Another is where we're scanning large data, where it's too large to fit into memory. And these both actually come up pretty often in real systems. So they're real access patterns for files, and we're kind of concerned about them because it's not just going to affect accesses to those files. Those are not just going to be inefficient, but we're also going to be using space in memory that could be caching things where we could do well. And so, like, just remember, if we're caching stuff we only read once, that's going to take up space in our cache that we really want to have used for other things that we want to keep in memory. And so operating systems are going to actually do things about these particular patterns. I'm going to first talk about sort of something focusing on this only read once, but it also applies to these repeated scans. And this is about trying to sort of deprioritize these pages, which we might either only be reading once, or if we're reading it multiple times, we're not going to reread it until we access a whole bunch of other stuff in the file. And the idea here is to look for these accessing only once in a long time periods. So Linux tries to do this, and it basically has this special heuristic for file pages, which is, it says, when you access some data in a file, I'm going to not consider it used right away. I'm going to consider it inactive at the beginning, and they implement this by putting it on the inactive list, it turns out. But basically, they don't consider it used until they see a second access. So they, then they add it to the active list and say, you're probably using this. And this way, when you access a file only once, Linux will preferentially throw those files away from memory rather than using space that could be used for more important data. And the key reason to do this is that if you don't make this change, whenever a program reads large files, it slows down all the other programs because that large file, as it's being actively read, is the most recently used thing. And it evicts the space all the other programs, which aren't quite as active at the moment, are using. And that's like really annoying. And so this is their heuristic for avoiding this problem. Okay, so questions about this heuristic here. That just waiting for a second access to handle these one uses or these scans where it's going to be a while between each time we look at a part of, say, a big movie. So another thing OSs do based on these patterns is that there's a realization that, wait, even though these patterns are really bad for LRU, they're actually patterns and you can predict them. They're just LRU is not a good way of predicting them. And let's think about, say, our movie. And if we think from the OS's perspective, we have our movie player. It accesses page 4 of the movie file, page 5, then page 6. Can we make a prediction about what page is next? Well, it's pretty easy, as a human, to say, okay, I saw 4, then 5, then 6. Like, Maybe it could be like 100 that's next, but probably it's 7. So something operating systems are going to try to do is make this guess and do this before the program actually accesses page 7. And this is called read ahead, because the idea is that, you know, we're going to check whether, you know, check, you know, what the program's reading and read ahead of where the program is. And this is going to greatly improve performance for a lot of common patterns in programs, especially because this is also, as we're going to learn later, let us take advantage of how hard drives and SSDs work in that they, like us, you know, they're faster to read bigger chunks. So let's think about read ahead. And here I have three ideas. So one idea is, you know, when we have a page fault that requires reading, say, a page X of a file, we read two pages. So that's a very simple way of implementing read ahead. And I have some other options here. So one is, I say, when I read some page that's far enough into the file, I just read the rest of the file. Another idea is when I have a page fault for a page of a file, I read a big range, including that page, and add them all to the page table. And another is I read a big range, but only add the one that was just read to the page table. So my question is, which of these seems most sensible? And none of these are actually very good, but they're going to get us to think about the sort of issues we have when designing a scheme for doing read ahead. And you can think of like what refinements we'd make like to get an improved solution. We'll give people another 30 seconds. Okay, so most people think probably D is best, and I think probably it's the best of these schemes. Can someone volunteer a problem with D via text? And let's see, because there are things to not like about D. So our question is, where do we put the pages? So in all these schemes, when we read in a page, we're evicting something if memory is full, and we're going to use probably LRU to do that. Or not LRU, but an LRU approximation. So other questions or ideas about like something we don't like, D. So the question is, if the file is not read sequentially, this may perform poorly. So yeah, so one, I wasn't thinking about that. So one concern is that, you know, none of these schemes actually, none of these, you know, verify sequential accesses. So that's something that might be a concern. That if the file's not read sequentially, we aren't actually checking if it's read sequentially. That's like, seems bad. Another problem I saw with D is that we end up reading one page at a time. Because after, say, for page zero, we read in 200 pages, but after that, for page one, we're gonna get another page full because we didn't load the page table immediately, and then we're going to only read one extra page, but we'd really want to read in bigger chunks. So that's sort of a problem with D that B fixes. So question is the difference between reading a page and placing it on a page table. So remember when we talked about mapping files, we said we had our page table and we had sort of our program's pages, and we said we could have the page table not have an entry, but we could actually have the cache data be there. Then when a page fault happens, we'd still have a page fault, but rather than actually loading the data, we just make the connection and update the page table to point to the already cached data. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah, so that's a problem. So reading one page at a time is a problem with D that, you know, B doesn't have. So let's talk about problems with A. So a problem with A is that we still, you know, have half of the time waiting for reads. So we aren't reading ahead enough with A as much as we could. With B, we might pollute memory. If the file is really big, we might evict too many things and really hurt our performance. And this is sort of a trade-off we're going to have to make with read-ahead, which is how do we like read-ahead enough to be useful, but not so much that the program that we like hurt the things we're supposed to be caching. And with C, like we're saving on the cost of extra page faults, but we still have to wait when we get to x plus 201 because we didn't detect whether or not there was an access to x to anything in between. So with the C scheme, you know, we're going to save the time with those page faults, but we're not going to know if the program has caught up to where we've read, and we're going to end up having to wait later on rather than, as with D, proactively reading to make sure we stay ahead of where the program is. So questions about sort of my critiques of these schemes. Okay. So this is, you know, sort of, we have these. So this is sort of the considerations to think about. So we have to think of how do we detect the reading pattern? And we have sort of ways in our examples, which all were kind of deficient in like looking for a sequential pattern, but they looked for something. We need to think about like what is, you know, when do we want to start reads? Do we read one page ahead, a lot of pages ahead? We want to stay ahead of the program, but not too much ahead, because if we stay too much ahead, we'll evict other stuff. If we stay too little ahead, well, you know, we won't keep up and we won't make efficient use of, it turns out, our hard drives or solid state disks. Okay. So that's on read ahead. And read ahead is the last topic I'm planning on covering for virtual memory. So we're going to move on to devices, but first we'll take questions on virtual memory. So we have this idea that we had this page cache, which cached program memory and files, where everything, you know, could have been moved to disk if needed, and memory just caches it. We mentioned that we mostly work with this working set model and use these sort of variations on least recently used to make that efficient as far as what we kept in memory. We have these special cases for some non-LRU patterns, like scans or files accessed only once. And you might think from that, okay, you had these two special cases, maybe there's more? There probably are. And this is sort of something that operating system designers need to think about is, well, what are my programs actually doing and how can I detect that and take advantage of that? We also mentioned being proactive, that we don't need to wait until the program does something. So we could say, you know, make sure we don't write back at the last moment, you know, because we have this idle time, we can make sure we read ahead of the program, you know, rather than having the program need to wait, and we can pre-evict things rather than doing all the work of going editing all the page tables on demand. And there's a topic where we're going to skip this semester, but I just want to mention it exists. Like, I talked about optimizing sort of throughput or miss rate, but there's other types of goals you might have which are very different, like fairness. And you'd want a very different family of mechanisms for that, probably, which would sort of incorporate LRU, but in a way which lets us take it into account other factors. So questions on the page cache and replacement before we move on to talking about devices. So, you may recall a while ago, we talked about, So the question is, how does page caching work with the processor caches you may have learned about in 3330 or some other course? So they are sort of layered on top of each other. But the processor caches typically work with physical addresses and happen entirely after the page table translation. So they're independent in that sense. That's the most common way things work. And as for the block sizes versus the page size, essentially always, processor caches are not going to have blocks which cross a page boundary, because that would be really annoying to implement in the hardware. So they'll at least have the, you know, block sizes be the page size will be, you know, evenly divided into cache blocks for the processor caches. Does that answer your question? Okay. So let's talk about kernel buffering that we talked about earlier. So remember I said that, you know, when we have, say, a key press, it goes into a buffer, and the program, you know, later on requests data and it gets satisfied from that buffer. Or similarly, when we read something from a file, well, it's not probably not already going to be in a buffer if the file wasn't cached. If it was, well, that's great. We learned what that buffer is now too. But if we need to, we're going to trigger a read and then satisfy it via the buffer. And this buffer is, you know, in this case, probably the page cache. And we also learned that there was buffering for writes. And for something like the network, we have a buffer waiting for output. For a file on disk, we have a buffer waiting for disk. This buffer is the page cache, and the other one isn't. But we saw like this big idea that we had this layering where, you know, when you wrote something to a file or even to, you know, a keyboard, read from a keyboard or read from a network device, you weren't actually communicating directly with that device. There was always this indirection that you went to some sort of buffer first. In the case of regular files, that buffer is the page cache. In the case of other types of devices, there's still going to be a dedicated buffer, but it's not going to be like a cache because it's not storage, right? We don't cache the packets that are currently being sent for this video. That doesn't make sense. And you may recall that we had this layering, and where we have, you know, multiple layers of buffers, we have the standard library doing its own buffers, and then we have these read-or-write system calls, and then the kernel's buffers. And we have this thing below that labeled device drivers. And we're going to talk about how do these device drivers work. And these device drivers are what's, you know, filling or draining those buffers. That we have these buffers for particular devices. You know, it could be regular files that are cached or things like stuff waiting to go out of the network or just coming in from the network. And these device drivers are responsible for filling that and managing that. And we're going to talk about how those work. Now, device drivers are kind of have like two kinds of interfaces that exist. So when we're going to sort of talk about device drivers generically, but you know, but there's two kinds of interfaces. So we have this sort of read-write or mmap sort of system call interface, and that has to somehow turn into talking to the devices. And there's two kind of ways that happen. So one way is that we have like files on disk. In that case, there's these POSIX calls these regular files. And there's something called a file system which manages that, and the file system works with the page cache. So works with the page cache, but the file system needs to bring in its data from the actual devices, so it talks to a device driver to figure out, oh, I know where this file's data is, can you get it for me, and so on. We also have files which represent devices which don't act like regular files. For example, we learned that when you're talking to the keyboard and the screen in XV6, there's a file descriptor you use, and we'll call these device files. So these are files which sort of directly represent a device, like a keyboard or a screen or a network, and they have the same interface. And in this case, the device driver will be more directly responsible for what those system calls do. And they're on a typical Unix-like system, there are lots of device files, and they all have the same interface as files. You open them to start accessing the device, you read data or write data, and then you close. And those device drivers are going to expose that kind of interface within the kernel. So basically, the kernel's going to look up, oh, it's the file for this device, and just going to essentially forward the read or the write call to the device driver, essentially unchanged, and it will handle that file interface based on what type of device it is. As I said, there's devices for everything. So from a Linux desktop, for example, there's a device to represent audio playback. So if you want to play audio, you a program or a library opens this file, then does some stuff to configure the device, and then uses the write call to send the audio data, which then gets translated into sound via some sort of stuff happening. There's device files that represent disks, which typically the file system is going to access, but you can access directly. And so you can like open up the disk, seek to a particular place and read it, and that talks to the device driver to read directly from the disk. There's devices to represent, say, the mouse and keyboard. So you open them up and you call read and you get, here's what the keyboard is doing, here's what the mouse is doing, and so on. And there's a device to represent, say, the graphics output, you know, which you can open up and write to, or probably mmap in order to send stuff to the screen. And the interface that these devices want to provide varies a lot between the type of devices. And you know, often you can think of, like, for here, like, a way of mapping read and write to what the devices want to do, but or mmap, but sometimes that's not enough. So, for example, for the audio output device, we need to say what format's the audio in. Typically, the audio hardware supports a whole bunch of them. Or we want to, like, configure, you know, read information like, are the headphones plugged in? And that doesn't really map naturally to read or write. Or for the terminal, we want to say whether to echo back what the user types. That's sometimes supported by sort of the software or the device, hardware or the device driver. Or for, say, a CD or DVD drive, you know, we want to have a way to open the disk tray or ask if a disk is present. And this doesn't map naturally to read or write. So typically, we provide some extra operations. Most notably, POSIX has a library call called IOCTL for IO control. And the idea of this call is that the device can provide all these extra operations there because, yeah, we're going to need it. Another option is that you can, like, have a control device file. So a single device driver might have multiple device files it manages, and some of them might sort of be meta devices, like a sound control file that configures what all the other sound devices do. Okay, so questions about sort of how we interact with device files. Okay, and in a typical implementation, like, basically the device driver implements just exactly the functions you would expect, read, write, these extra operations like IOCTL, mmap, and so on, and they can provide whatever implementation they want. Now, devices used by the page cache are usually a special case. So for things like disks, we typically have a different interface for working with the page cache. So for example, in Linux, the things like disks implement this interface, and this is what the page cache uses when it wants to talk to the disk to load data into the cache. And it has this read or write page operation, just acknowledging that we actually want to work in units of pages, and that's going to be more convenient for both the page cache and for the implementer of the device driver. Now, regardless of the interface, we're going to talk about what sort of what the flow in the device driver is. And sort of here is the diagram I have. And we're going to divide this up into two pieces, because this is going to run in different threads. So we have this top, what I'll call the top half. And this is run in the thread that does the read or the write or whatever, you know, operation triggers the actual I.O. or the, so for example, the page miss or whatever. And in that thread, we're going to have part of the device driver run. And this is going to, like, figure out, oh, you're asking to read, you're asking to write. It's going to check its buffers. We talked about having buffers. So we're going to check those buffers, figure out, do I actually need to do anything? So for example, let's say I read from the keyboard. Maybe I've already pressed those keys. In that case, we can just skip ahead to this step. Otherwise, if it's not satisfied, we're going to do the work to talk to the device hardware to send the operation if we need to. So like for a keyboard, we probably don't, because the keyboard is just going to tell us when it's ready. Like if we're talking to like a network device to write data, well, we definitely do. We need to say, hey, here's some data to send on the network. And then if the operation is not going to happen right away, we put the current thread to sleep and let something else run. Then we have a bottom half of the device driver, which is going to run as part of the trap handler. So this is going to run interrupting whatever else is happening on the system. And this is going to be from trap. So the call for trap is going to run this code and then return back to the program that was interrupted by the device saying, hey, that operation you sent me earlier, I'm done with it, or hey, something like, I have a key press. So this handler, like, gets the interrupt from the device, it updates the buffers, and then does sort of extra work. So one big thing it needs to do is we put a thread to sleep, we need to wake it up and tell it, hey, I have your results in the buffer, why don't you figure out what you need to do with that? And maybe we detect here that, oh, you only partially did what I asked, let me send the rest. So that's sort of, this is the stuff which happens from the interrupt. And notice that, like, this is going to be pretty minimal. We don't actually deal with the particular read-or-write call. And usually we want to try to make this very fast because it's running in the middle of something else. So now when we get the data in the buffer, sort of our flow here is we store the data in the result and usually we return. Sometimes you might discover, hey, you asked me to read, you know, until a new line or read 20 characters. I don't have 20 yet. And we might go back and, you know, go back to sleep or something like that. So questions about this overall flow. So let's look at how this works in XV6, which is going to have things be very simple. So in XV6, a device file implements only read and write, and there's only a few device files, in fact. And the device file takes this argument saying, what file is it? But more importantly, there's this array of all the possible devices. And this is just filled in on boot, and there's a special type of file on disk to represent a device, and basically what's stored on the disk is a device number, which is just an index into this array. And there's a system call to create this special file called makenode, and this is basically the scheme that's used on Unix or Linux. On Unix or Linux, it's not an array, it's, you know, basically like a hash table, and they have not just one number, but two numbers. But the idea is that we have a file on disk, which says, you know, this is the data for this file isn't actually on disk. This is just a pointer to a device, and here's an identifier for the device, so the device can have a name. Okay. So questions about our device numbers. So once we have this index into an array, you know, we need to like have this set up. So in XV6, you know, code at boot just initializes an entry in this array for index one, which is the console, for to have a read or write entry. And basically, this is what your standard in or standard out in XV6 is. So when you read from standard inputs, you're reading, calling console read. When you write from to standard output, you're calling console write, assuming you haven't done any redirection or anything like that. So let's look at the code that's in this read and write function. And we've already seen the part where we get the request. That's handling the read or the write system call, and that's going to forward to this console read or console write function. So let's look at console read. And console read, you know, our first step is going to check, is it satisfied from the buffer? And then to, you know, put the thread to sleep. We aren't going to send the IO operation because we don't have to do anything to get input from the keyboard, it turns out. So this is the implementation of console read, and it has this while loop, which is while there's stuff in the buffer, you know, while the buffer is empty, while the reading end of the buffer is the same place where we're writing the buffer, meaning it's empty, put the thread to sleep. Okay, so that's the first piece of logic, is check if like we have stuff in the buffer. If we don't, put the thread to sleep to wait for stuff in the buffer. Then our second step is going to be, well, now that we have stuff in the buffer, either because it was there to begin with, so we checked if there was stuff, or because we put the thread to sleep and woke up, Now, store that data into the result. So the rest of this code is we have this loop where we get a character from the buffer and copy it to the destination that's the user specified. And this is just what the argument to read was. So we're just copying it into where the argument to read was. And then we figure out, did we actually complete the read? And XV6 just has this hard-coded rule that the read is done when we've read enough characters or we've hit a new line. And based on that, we decide whether to return or to go back to putting the thread to sleep. Okay, so that's our sort of the top half of this device driver. So notice that we aren't actually, in this case, talking to the keyboard because that's all going to be done from the bottom half because, you know, we don't have to do anything to say, start sending me keys for the keyboard. Okay, so questions about this top half? So I now feel like I'm rushing through things. So then we have the bottom half. So in the bottom half, we get an interrupt, and we know in XV6, this goes to the trap function. So part of the trap function is dealing with something like keyboard input. There's actually multiple ways to get input for the console. We'll just talk about keyboard input to keep things simple. And there's a case with this number, and this is just the number for the trap for the keyboard input. Is this combination of constants, and it calls this function keyboard enter, which is the actual device driver for the keyboard, the bottom half of it, the half which deals with interrupts. And this is going to happen when it would, no matter what's running, when we press a key, this code triggers. And we have the second half, which is telling the CPU, hey, I'm done with the interrupt, stop telling me about it. If we didn't do this, the CPU would think, oh, you didn't actually handle this interrupt, let me tell you about it again. Let's look at this top part, and that's where we're going to actually get the data from the device and update the buffer that the read call might be using. So this is the keyboard interrupt function actually reads from the device, then copies that data it read into the buffer, if there's room, and wakes up any sleeping thread. So questions about sort of this high-level view. And the question we're going to get to next is like, how do we do this operation? How do we actually read from the device? But to answer that, we're going to have to think about how our device is actually connected to our machine. But before I get to that, any questions about what I've shown so far? Okay, so we know when we read, but we don't know how we read. And we also kind of glossed over how do devices actually trigger an interrupt. So the model I'm going to use for how devices are connected to our machine is we already talked about this memory bus where our memory was connected and also other processors. We're going to attach what we'll call a device controller to the memory bus. And the convenience of this is we don't need to add any more outputs to the processor. We just use the one we already have, and we just say, well, we already can attach multiple things to this. Why not attach devices too? And this device controller is going to be responsible for understanding how the memory bus works and also understanding how the hardware we're connecting works. So in the case of the keyboard device controller, it knows how the keyboard actually works, but it also understands the memory bus and it's kind of acting as an intermediary. And you know, we're not going to talk about the details about this protocol here, like how this communication works. We're just going to care about what the OS needs to know, which is how the device controller presents itself on the memory bus. We also have this second line here, which is probably like attached to the memory bus, which is attached to what we call the interrupt controller. So there's a separate way each of these devices can be connected to the processor to signal, hey, I want to trigger an interrupt now. And the device controller is responsible for making that decision about when to do that. Now, for actually, accessing the device controller is connected to the memory bus, and the operations we can send on the memory bus are reading or writing memory. And that's how we're going to talk to the device controller. So the device controller is going to have what we'll call control registers. So for example, one of them might be the status. Like, do I have, data for you now or not? Or one of them might be like a trigger to do operations. So if this read flag is set, start reading from the network, for example. If this write flag is set, start writing to the network. And we're also going to have some buffers or queues. So for key presses, this would be like, here's the most recent key press. And each of these control registers, we're going to make accessible like it was memory. So the device controller, it's getting memory addresses on this line. It can figure out, okay, you use the memory address I use for my status. Here you go, here's my status. And it can also support writes in that way. So the device controller is going to expose these control registers to look like memory that can be read and or written. And it's going to make it so it changes values in the device controller. And because the device controller, is just looking at the data on the memory bus, it doesn't actually need to have all of these act like registers. So for example, it could detect when you're writing to this write flag, and maybe it doesn't actually update a register or a stored value. Maybe it actually just triggers an operation on the external hardware, which it can do because, it's just interpreting the signals on the memory bus. It can do that how it wants. So it can turn your write operation into some actual action on the actual device. The other thing we had here was these buffers and queues, and we can also assign memory addresses to them. We can just make this device controller say, okay, I have a memory address that's going to be the keyboard buffer, and I'm just going to make sure when you try to read from that, I send you what's in my keyboard buffer, just like I were part of memory. So questions about sort of how this way of connecting our devices to the processor. So another thing that might happen that's pretty common is I talked about the device controllers being directly connected to the memory, but often there's more layers and we might have what we'll call a bus adapter, and we'll have some different interface. And we'll have device controllers on that different interface, and the bus adapter will be responsible for translating between the two. So one example of how this happens would be like USB. We have a USB adapter/controller, which translates for all the devices connected to the USB plugs. Okay, and the question is, the device controller is something like a SATA controller for disk drives, and if assuming you mean the part which is like not on the disk drive, yes. Okay. So there's often indirection. We're just going to mostly ignore that, but it mostly works out the same because this bus adapter will make things work. So we can think of this as magic memory. Because the device controller decides what those memory locations do, the device is just some magical memory locations where read and write instructions do amazing things that memory usually doesn't do. So for example, our keyboard controller, we read from a memory location and we get a key press or release, the last value of the last key press or release. And that memory location doesn't have to act like normal memory. For example, the keyboard controller XV6 uses, when you read from that location, it clears the buffer. It figures you're going to want to do that anyway. Why not make it more convenient? And also, there's some action with you get an interrupt, at least if you haven't disabled it, whenever there's a one you haven't read yet. And we can do similar things for other types of devices. So for example, a display controller, we might write the image that we want displayed on the screen to a memory location and it just shows up. Maybe we have other memory locations which change the screen size or format of that information. Or for a network device, we're going to write to buffers on the network, on the network's device controller, and then we just write a send now signal, and that doesn't actually like change anything we're going to read. It just sends that data we put in the buffer earlier, and later on there's a status location which is going to be automatically updated telling us, here's how much I've written. Okay. So that's sort of this model of how device controllers can expose their functionality to the OS. So it's, you know, it's actually fairly convenient. We just, you know, read and write memory, and that works. Now, there's some important little details here because this is looks like read and write to memory. And the big thing is that this goes to processor caches. And I talked about that magic memory, we read the last key press. Okay, so let's say our device driver does that. So I press H, the OS reads my H. And our question is, if we have processor caches, does that get cached? Well, if it's just memory as far as the processor is concerned, which is how it looked because this was all outside the processor, then let's say I press E and the OS reads. Well, if it's cached, we have a problem. The OS is going to read the H, because the OS, the processor is going to use the cached version. So the device driver, you know, won't get the right information. Now, we could imagine a solution to this where the device controllers play along with the cache coherency protocol to make this happen, but this is basically not done. Instead, we're going to make the OS do a little extra work. And we're going to have the OS mark the memory as uncacheable and tell the processor, hey, this physical address, I know it talks to a device controller and not real memory, so please don't cache it. And in x86, for example, there's a bit in the page table entry to mark memory as no caching. And the processor pays attention to this and doesn't cache that precisely to support this kind of interaction with devices. That's about caching. Now, I have to talk about, to show you XV6's code for communicating with the keyboard, an unfortunate historical thing about x86. So I talked about devices being connected to memory. Historically, there was often a separate bus which works like the memory bus but has separate addresses and separate instructions called I/O addresses on x86. And for this is what XV6 uses to talk to the keyboard. But all the operations work the same as if using the memory bus. We just have different move instructions. We have in and out instead of move. And more recent processors and devices use memory addresses because that actually turns out to be, for most things, much more convenient. Both you don't have to add instructions, you don't have to add extra things to attach to your processor. And we're going to have other reasons we'll talk about next time to keep devices and memory close. But as I said, other than using different instructions and different addresses, it basically works the same as if it were memory mapped. So here's the code for actually accessing the keyboard in XV6. And we have this inb function, which is a wrapper around that special in instruction. And we have two addresses, which are just constants. We have the address of the keyboard status register and the address of the keyboard data buffer. And what we do is we check the status register. There's a bit in that register which says, is there data to read? And if there isn't, we return an error to the thing that calls this. If not, we read from that and then add it to our buffer. And this read, because it's magic memory, clears that buffer. So questions about what I'm showing here. So this is the code that runs in that bottom half of the keyboard device driver, so during the trap handler. And this is just to fill the buffer by communicating with the device. So, what I've shown you is what we've known as programmed I.O. So, where we're reading and writing directly from the buffers, and often still triggered by the interrupt, and we have to run a loop, like we have to get each key press separately to get the data. We're going to talk about some alternatives to that next time, when we finish up talking about devices. So, any final questions before I leave off? Guess.